This podcast is supported by Australian Ethical. Australian Ethical grow your retirement savings without sacrificing integrity of performance, so you can build a better future for yourself and our world. Because when your super prospers, we all thrive. Please read the FSG, PDS and TMD on the website to consider if the product is right for you and the ethical guide to understand how they invest. Issued by Australian Ethical Superannuation Proprietary Limited, AFSL 526055.
This is The Guardian.
Regid Ahmed here on Gadigal land with the full story. This summer, one of the oldest and fiercest rivalries in sport continues as England take on Australia in the Ashes. It's a contest that's been going on for more than 140 years, and this time it takes place on Australian soil. Australia have had the upper hand in recent times, but England will try to reverse that streak as they attempt to win a test match in Australia for the first time in almost 15 years. To help you follow all the action, we'll be replaying episodes of the Guardian Ashes weekly podcast throughout the summer.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Ashes Weekly, supported by Qantas, the spirit of Australia. Australia win the first test in 2 days. Seems like not enough days. What an extraordinary test match. First, Mitchell Starc won the game in the first over, then got career best figures, then England came out and bowled like the West Indies in the 80s, all fast, all accurate. It was devastating bowling. Then Duckett and Pope looked to be meandering comfortably to a huge lead, then a Baz Bawley wafting at wide ones collapse, then Carson Atkinson gave England a lead of 205. It felt big, and then Travis Head thought, I'll just do this by myself. And here we are. Questions then. As always with Baz Ball, when it doesn't work, it looks so bad. Is it worth asking if England will change when we know they won't? Millions of bleary-eyed Englishmen with heating on at 3 a.m. saying, don't drive at another wide one. Or should we just congratulate Travis Head and somehow pray it's different next time? This was England's chance. No Cummings, no Hazelwood. Australia having to fiddle their top order. And we blew it. How annoying. I'm Max Rushton and welcome to the Guardian Ashes Weekly. On the panel today, cricket correspondent Ali Martin. Hey, Ali.
Hi, Max. Good to see you. And yeah, the spirit of Australia was certainly on show yesterday.
It was, wasn't it? Guardian cricket writer Jim Wallace. Welcome, Jim.
Hello, everybody.
And the Guardian Australia's Jeff Lemon. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, hello, hello from Perth. Yeah. Well, I don't know. What do we say? Where do you start, Max? What do you do?
Well, Nick says Ashes Weekly might have been an overly ambitious name for this podcast. There are so many statistics coming out of this
game.
Yeah, I will just read. I'll just read a few of the stats. First time in 104 years, an Ashes Test match has been wrapped up inside 2 days. The second quickest Test match ever played on Australian soil. The third shortest Ashes match. England's two innings lasted a combined 405 balls. That's the fastest they've been bowled out twice in a test since 1904. Travis Head's 100 off 69 balls, the equal third fastest by an Australian in tests, the joint fastest by an opener, and the second fastest 100 in an Ashes test after that Adam Gilchrist run at the Wacker in 06. Rab says it's nice they played a two-day game as a prelude. Do you think England will be better when the test series starts? We've had a night to sleep on it, Jeff. And I imagine it becomes a Baz Ball inquest pretty quickly, but should we start by congratulating Australia?
To a point, yes. But this is, I mean, this was a game that was finished off by a freak innings, and 200 could have been enough, given the match that we saw play out before it. You know, any game where you need to make the highest score of the match in the fourth innings means it should be difficult in theory. But we also know, and we've seen this in England a lot over the last few years, that there are pitches that ease off, that flatten out, and that become easier to bat on later in the game, particularly when the fourth innings is on day two. Like, let's just come back to that point. The fourth innings being on day five is more likely to make it difficult to bat than the fourth innings being on day two. I realise that's a relatively self-evident thing to say, but it's worth emphasising that. So the fact that England play in such fast-forward fashion, even though they'd given themselves something to bowl at, means that the relative degree of difficulty, a bit like Headingley 2019 with Stokes, where he was batting, you know, halfway through the fourth day, not deep into the fifth day, you're never going to have as much to play with as a bowling side in terms of defending a score. So, yes, you can look at that Travis Head bit, but ultimately, for me, it's the incredible wastefulness of England's batting, which they got away with in the first innings by somehow managing to sneak away with the lead. But second time around, you're over 100 in front, you've got 9 wickets in hand, and you manage to botch it with not just some of your players, but your best players, your most important players, Brook, Root, playing stupid shots that are just totally unsuited to the conditions. And particularly in Joe Root's case, this is an experienced player who's been here plenty of times before and knows how he's got out before. That's the most culpable part of the entire exercise.
So the basketball inquest has started. That's fine. I had to go and do something for 10 minutes and duck it in Popery. I came back and I walked it up and Harry Brook was walking off the pitch, Jim. And I was like, "That's what's happened there? That's ridiculous."
Yeah, that was carnage after lunch in the media centre at the Perth Stadium. There was a lot of sort of Aussie journalists sort of in the doldrums at you know, when they're having their lunchtime curry, and they were saying, you know, England are going to bat us out of this. This is going to be all their old guys are going down. Khawaja's looking all of his 39 years. Nathan Lyon's looking a bit dodgy. A couple of long sessions in the dirt could have polished a few of them off. And then I was getting a lift back up, and I said, don't underestimate this England side's capacity to grab defeat from the jaws of victory. So I actually sort of had a sniff, sort of an inkling that something was going to happen. And just on Root, Jeff, he was down the other end watching those wickets as well. So that was the real gut punch, I think, when Root chops that one on. And, you know, and he couldn't even drag himself from the crease. He sort of lay impaled over his bat for a good few seconds, sort of couldn't believe what he'd done. So, yeah,
He's faced Mitchell Starc before, Jim. Like, Joe Root and Mitchell Starc have been around for a while, and they've been around for the same while. You go back to sort of 2012, they've played God knows how many test matches against each other. He knows what Mitchell Starc does. He bowls quick left arm and angles it across you and sometimes swings one back in. And he's like, yeah, I think that's the ball that I'm going to try to smash on the up through cover point just after Harry Brooks got out. I think that's the one for me after I've made eight. It was just a bizarre lack of thinking from the one thinking player. England are supposed to have one thinking player in the side, and that's him. Australia are supposed to have one baseball style player in the side, and that's Travis Head. And the one Australian player beat the 11 England players. So
it's like being on a stag do, and the one sensible bloke is sort of tops off on the bar at 6 p.m.
You're the designated driver.
We've got three more days in Benidorm to go. This is going to be a long old weekend. Yeah.
He's shaved off, you know, someone else's eyebrow. You're like, Joe, you're not meant to be that guy. But Ali, I'm not saying it's futile to have a conversation about those three players not driving at wide ones on this pitch against this sort of bowling. But it's not going to change what they do, is it? Or is it?
I don't think it's going to change it fundamentally. I do think aggression is what suits this set of England players as selected, and it has served them well up to a point in the last 3 years. I've just been writing I'm just sort of halfway through writing my post-mortem of it, and I've compared it to like when you've literally told your toddler not to do something and they just do it anyway, you know, as Jeff rightly points out, for Root to be kind of tugging the cat's tail when you've just said, do not do that, or rather his eyes should have told him, do not do that, particularly on that Perth surface. I think it was the movement wasn't extravagant. There was about half a bat's width of nip. But in Perth, you have to play cross-batted to anything short. You've got to wait for the one that's very full, the half volley essentially, and try and push that down the ground. But trying to drive at a 45-degree angle, also because there's not a huge amount of value on these huge outfields, and it's a very slow outfield as well. I mean, obviously, you want to pick up your twos and threes where you can. But it just seemed such an unnecessary shot. The same goes for Brook. I mean, he is the less experienced of the two, but he is the vice captain. Ollie Pope is also the former vice captain. That is essentially what you're looking at as three senior players there who have let the side down. And I'm not even sure the kind of defeat from the jaws of victory holds that much, because the victory wasn't there yet. You know, like it wasn't, England were in a position at 99 for one, effectively, at lunch, 105 for one when the wicket of Duckett fell, where there was a challenge in front of them. Can you get through to tea? Can you get through to the point when traditionally, and I say traditionally, it's a pretty young ground in terms of Test cricket, but when the pitch does start to ease off? We saw it in the Test match against the India one 12 months ago, that they had to, I think I'm right in saying that they had to absolutely guts it out to get to the point and earn the right to get the conditions that Travis Head later exploited. 204, I mean, it was the highest score of the match. And, you know, if England get off to a better start, and perhaps even if Khawaja had been doing his job opening, that England could have made some early inroads. But, you know, England had to, if England wanted to make merry on that pitch, the time to do it was after tea on the second day. But equally, easier said than done. They should have been aware of the conditions of the... It wasn't just a sort of a serene, you know, glide through to lunch from Pope and Duckett. They had quite a bit of good fortune there. There was quite a bit of movement. There was one ball from Mitchell Starc. I don't know how it missed the stumps, but it just about did. You know, it was tough going out there, but it just felt a very shallow response to the situation in front of them. When they've been telling us for some time that they are growing and developing and learning to spot the moments in games when they have to really try and do the hard work, it felt to me like they were just trying to make a statement. They were trying to tip on Australia's heads far too early. The time to do that was after tea, but they couldn't even make it there.
Yep. And I reckon the first session, Ali, what you're talking about there is telling as well, because there was so much good fortune, because Pope played and missed God knows how many times. It felt like 12 or 15 times that he was playing, you know, not defending, but playing big drives at balls and missing them. When you've had so much good luck, when you've got through to lunch and you've gone, well, Jesus Christ, we've had some good fortune there and I'm still here. And then you come out in the second session and continue to play that way instead of respecting the fact that you've had some fortune to get where you are. That's the bit that really, really puzzles me. It's not like they were on top going into the lunch break, as you say. So there was clearly still work to do, and they just wrapped a bow around it and handed it back to Australia at that point. And I mean, if Khawaja holds the slip catch off Jamie Smith, they might not have been defending 204.
And actually, Jim, the thing I thought was interesting was Australia needed 205, and the way that England bowled in the first innings, I was like, this is going to be really tense. This is going to be so tight. But you saw immediately that those bowlers needed more time, needed more rest. They were all knackered, the pace of each of them, because in the first innings, and it is worth spending a bit of time...
They bowled 45 overs in the first innings. After day one?
Well, maybe I don't disagree with you. I don't know, but like it wasn't like one of their paces was down. It was like they were all down. So like the ball wasn't zipping through, because that opening spell, especially in the first innings when Smith and Labuschagne were there and it was so tense, I thought, I haven't seen an England pace attack bowl like this, Jim, where it was like... It didn't matter what change it was. It was still quick. It was still terrifying. And they had none of that in the second innings.
I think a lot of people, including chiefly Ben Stokes, thought they had enough runs. I think that partnership between Atkinson and Carr at the end, you know, giving it a bit of Humpty, playing some incredible shots, getting them up above 200. I think they thought, you know, it's nowhere near, it's not 300, it's not 350, but the chatter around, you know, a few ex-England captains were saying, I think that's enough if they bowl like they did in the first innings. But yeah, whether it was slightly tiredness or a shock that they were back in the field so soon, or I thought it went flat very, very quickly. Archer to Weatherall, the decision's overturned. England think they've nicked him off, but it's hit his back pocket, and that was sort of, they were on about 20 for none or something like that. And then I think I heard Stuart Broad saying, you know, he would have liked a lot more atmosphere and sort of England doing what they did in the first innings to go on a lot longer. But when it got to about 40 for none or whatever it was, it felt like this, you know, it was sort of getting away from them. The body language wasn't great. And yeah, it was sort of like lots of people have been comparing it to Adelaide 2006-07, where that was sort of like a slow griping loss, you know, one of England's worst anywhere, especially in Australia. Whereas this was like, boom, it was just done. It was like, I think that's why Stokes is saying he's shell-shocked. I think they thought they had a decent sniff, and then Travis Head does what he does, and it's gone, and it's inside 2 days, and they were like, oh, shit, that was a real one that got away.
I was interesting afterwards, because a lot of what Stokes said and McCullum was just, well, look, Travis Head's really good, nothing we could do type thing. There wasn't a lot of, and maybe publicly there's no self-reflection, and you presume privately there is, and maybe there isn't. But it did seem like someone could have said, yes, we gave away 5 wickets in the first innings for nothing. We had that big clutch in the second innings. You know, they were all just like, sometimes you just come up against a brilliant cricketer. And that's not taking away from Travis Head's innings. It was brilliant.
Yeah, it does feel like a bit of a cop out at the times. You would have thought the analysis goes a little bit deeper behind closed doors, but I do think that one of the things with this England team is they talk about keeping out the noise. which means kind of, you know, just operating in their own bubble. But I do think that comes with a slight detachment from reality at times. And they probably need to think a little bit more about, there's not a huge amount after such a crushing defeat that they could say that would sort of ease it. But I do think the England supporters probably would like to hear them being a little bit more reflective in their public appearances after a game. It is incredible in the space of 48 hours that the sheer momentum shift and the feeling amongst both sets of supporters, really. I mean, after day one, there genuinely were Australian voices, you know, wondering if they were about to watch the complete breakup of the Australian team in real time, because England had, you know, not stumbled across, but England have come here with a sustained pace battery, or so it looked. And also England support. I was chatting to one of the tour groups, the tour managers, and he was telling me that he was just taken aback by, after that first day, the number of people that had been in touch asking if they could extend their trips. You know, they saw just that day one performance with the ball and thought, you know, I want the full thing here.
Well, they have extended their trips. They've got three extra days off.
Hopefully he didn't say, look, I'll come to you on day three and we'll extend it. Hopefully he just said yes straight away and took the money, or he's screwed.
Yeah. I mean, so yeah, but back to your point. But I do think that in the post-match press conferences, there are times when England can sort of, what they say can clang a little bit. It doesn't change the result. It probably doesn't really take much of the edge off the feeling in the stands. And actually, a word on the England supporters, because I mean, aside from the Steve Smith chants, which I personally find a bit boring, I did think that was an incredible show of support, particularly for a team that was collapsing and then trying to will them over the line to get those 10 wickets. So kudos to that. 9,000, they kept singing. And England are going to need every bit of that if they're going to pull themselves out of this hole.
Sure. Especially because, you know, you spend a lot of money to come here. You know, I got tickets for day three in Melbourne. I'm like, I'm not sure. But sorry, Jeff, you were going to say.
Well, just the thing about saying that there's nothing you can do. You can say that when it's Stokes 135 at Headingley, right? You can say that when you've set a team 350 and somebody's played the innings of their life. You can't say it when you've set a team 200. You know, what you can do, the thing you could do is add 200 more runs to the target, right? The thing you can do is you've got to be able to set targets that can absorb a good innings or a good partnership, because you have to expect, if you're playing respectfully, if you're respecting the other team that you're up against, you've got to expect that they have players who will be able to play well on any given day, or maybe even 2 days, right? You've got to say, well, okay, set a target that can absorb somebody's good innings and still be good enough to beat them. And that's what England were in the position to do at 1 for 100, and that's what they didn't. I mean, this could be wheels off stuff. Like, and this Australian team is not that good. This is what I keep coming back to.
Oh, don't say that again.
You look at how they batted in the first innings. You look at how they fell apart in the first innings. That is not a surprising thing to happen from this Australian team. They play on pretty juicy pitches at home and have done for a few years, so that plays a part, that it's not as easy to make big scores. But gee whiz, they've been vulnerable a bunch of times with the bat over the last few years, and it's largely the same personnel. So they're patchy enough that they could give England opportunities, but if England can screw up this game this badly in what is clearly their best opportunity to win one in terms of the personnel they're up against, if you can't beat a team that's got Brendan Doggett on debut and Scott Boland bowling badly in the first innings and you're still all out for 170 and then you go worse second time around, where can you expect to win a game if you're England? I don't see a lot of upside for them.
But do keep listening to The Guardian Ashes Weekly, even if you don't want to watch any of the cricket. That'll do for parts.
I hope I'm wrong. Like, I genuinely hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, me too.
I didn't want to watch a 2-day test match, right? No. I didn't come all the way to frickin' Perth to watch 2 days of cricket. It is a long way to go from anywhere on the planet. And I don't want to watch 2-day tests anywhere else. I'm travelling around the country. So please, England, get your act together.
I had so many mates, you know, my whole Melbourne Uni old boys football team, all just like, oh, I had all of the Sunday afternoon on the sofa. I'd sorted it all out. I had all my plans and all just going, what am I going to do now? Anyway, that'll do for part one. We'll be back in a second.